This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This year is 47. It is still most likely well below the actual number of deaths. Deaths occurring in a hospital or under a physician's care are not reported to the medical examiner. More than half the reported deaths were accidental. 17 died from heroin overdoses, and 10 committed suicide. Multnomah County Commissioner Deborah Corfuri reported that several policy initiatives are underway to help prevent deaths of homeless people. Corfuri and others urged the county's two cooperative care organizations to adopt programs that pay for housing with Medicaid funds. A proposed bill in the Oregon Senate would expand the availability of naloxone, also known as Narcan, a drug that reverses overdoses. Paramedics and emergency room staff currently use Narcan, and the bill would expand availability to drug users, their friends and families, counselors, and others.
After months of fluoride debate, blog flames, and lawn sign mischief, Portland voters have their ballots in hand. Just in this last week, news stories broke about the effects of arsenic and the fluoridating chemicals. Portland's dental health is already improving, and some contributions to local nonprofits are on shaky legal ground. For an update on these issues, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Nicole Mayer of Northwest Health.
Northwest Health has been a longtime supporter of water fluoridation. For the current ballot measure effort, Northwest Health funded local nonprofits to help get the word out. I spoke with their executive director, Nicole Maher.
Is there a dental health crisis in Portland?
When you have more than 50% of first through third graders having a cavity, certainly that's unacceptable to me and to so many of our community partners.
Nicole, there's new data coming out showing a 10% improvement or lowering of caries in Portland. Are we moving in the right direction?
So there has been some improvements. I'm not sure if it's 10%. There has been some improvements, and I think that that is wonderful. We still have a crisis right now.
How do we know that we have a dental health crisis in Portland?
The best comparison is actually to look at Seattle and Portland, and you will see that we have a 40% higher rate of tooth decay than Seattle, which is fluoridated. So you can compare us to comparable communities and cities and see that.
Do you know of any known harms of putting these fluoridating chemicals in our water?
I do not. And there's been a lot of misinformation put out there and a lot of myths. And it's been really unfortunate because what we really need to do is look at what groups are supporting this effort and see that every major group supporting low-income children, communities of color, is actually endorsing and supporting this effort.
I think what both sides can agree on is there is some arsenic, for example, in these fluoridating chemicals.
There is absolutely no different in arsenic levels in water that is not fluoridated and water that is fluoridated.
No, both sides agree that we're putting some arsenic in our water.
There is no difference in arsenic in water that is fluoridated and non-fluoridated.
Dan Meek is quoted in Willamette Week as saying that it's highly unusual for PACs to be giving money to nonprofits. Normally, it's the other way around.
I just have a disagreement with Dan Meeks on that. It's actually a fairly common practice, and we see many examples of it. I think what's interesting is that the grants were largely made to organizations of color who historically have not been engaged in these types of activities, and I think people were just not accustomed to it.
What does Northwest Health expect from these grants?
Well, we're a partner with the campaign, and we expect that these communities and these organizations be very involved in educating their communities, engaging them in voting, and outreaching about this particular issue.
And aren't you also squeezing out voices from other organizations like NAACP who may have a different perspective?
I was not aware that there was an NAACP that existed in Portland until they spoke up about being anti-fluoride.
I'm not saying you didn't reach out to them. I'm saying other people will have a voice, and they have a certain volume of voice because they have a certain amount of resources.
Well, I think that's a larger question about campaigns and finances in general. You know, we don't blink twice about paying and supporting for campaigns and organizing to reach out to voters. I'm not sure why it's such an issue that we're being intentional and thoughtful about reaching out to people who historically haven't been involved. I'm not sure what the problem is with that.
That was Nicole Maher of Northwest Health, and this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
The Rules Committee of the Oregon House today passed Oregon House Bill 2669, which extends civil rights protections to interns. Bridget Burns, the chief of staff of the Oregon University System, spoke in favor of the bill during the meeting earlier today. She noted that internships have become vital to securing jobs after completing higher education. She says that as universities continue to expand their internship programs, it would be helpful if they could provide their students with the same rights as employees. Representative Vicky Berger expressed concern about the risk assumed by the employer.
A group of environmental activists occupied the shareholder meeting of Bank of America in Chicago this week. They called on the bank to stop investing in coal projects, including mountaintop removal, mines in southeast, and coal export terminals in the Pacific Northwest. Portland activist Bonnie McKinley with 350.org and Power Past Coal participated in the shareholder action. She spoke with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about that meeting and actions planned this weekend here in Portland with Power Past Coal.
And I wonder if you can talk about what your focus was there at the shareholders meeting.
Our focus was presenting the case to Bank of America, who sometimes purports to be a green energy leader. They do give a certain amount of money to renewable and green projects. However, they are the biggest investor in coal projects in the U.S. That includes companies like Arch Coal and Peabody Coal. Arch with Amber Energy is working very hard to push through the Longview coal export terminal. And Peabody Coal is pushing for the Gateway Pacific Coal Export Terminal up in Bellingham, Washington.
How did you manage to get in as an activist?
Well, I have a lot of friends and people who are active. And I know people in Rainforest Action Network, and they're the ones that put this together. They've been meeting with Bank of America for quite a while. They did attend the shareholders conference last year. They arranged to have proxy shares. So 35 to 40 of us from all over the world went and had our two-minute question commentary for them. And I believe that it's quite evident we dominated the question-answer period. I think the main message was that Bank of America can't have it two ways. They can't be the biggest contributor to coal, be it companies that engage in mountaintop removal or our coal export terminals, and pretend or assume or sort of in some small degree support renewable energy. You can't do both.
And can you talk about this weekend? I understand that the local Power Past Coal is organizing a couple of events, and you need volunteers tomorrow at the St. John's Parade.
Right. The St. John's Parade. And we'll have a number of people we have coal banners, anti-coal banners, and we'll also have a renewable energy aspect, people wearing solar panels, holding sunshine, and people sitting in turbines. So we are opposed to coal, but we do have alternatives. If people would like to come to St. John's Parade and be involved with us, they could call the following number, 503-515-5209, and tell Mike that you want to be in the parade. I'm going to repeat that number, 503-515-5209. And we have a number of costumes and a number of banners, and we'd like to have as many of them in use as possible during the parade.
The phone number again for people who are interested in getting involved in tomorrow's parade, 503-515-5209, or you can show up at 10 a.m. at the north end of Roosevelt High School in St. John's at North Lombard and North Ida Street. Again, that's the north end of Roosevelt High School at 10 a.m. tomorrow to be part of the Power Past Coal procession in the St. John's Parade. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
Officials at Willamette University announced they're calling for the creation of a sexual assault task force in the wake of the scandal involving the Sigma Chi fraternity's Facebook page. A dozen members of the fraternity were voted out by peers on Wednesday for discussing female students and faculty members in a sexually explicit and degrading manner. Some Sigma Chi members also spoke about hazing pledges, secret on-campus parties and drinking, activities that caused the removal of their charter at a variety of campuses across the nation in recent years. The Bishop Wellness Center at Willamette University will help to assemble a task force, which is expected to be composed of faculty, students, and staff, as well as independent experts.
Colton Harris Moore, the remarkable young man who became known as the Barefoot Bandit after crossing the United States in stolen planes that he had taught himself to fly, ended a three-year saga as he made his final appearance in court yesterday. The 22-year-old has agreed to a plea deal with prosecutors. He will serve a sentence of 6.5 years in federal prison for a wide variety of charges related to his two-year flight from authorities. In a statement released yesterday, Harris Moore, thanking supporters and the amazing people with whom he has worked, told the court that he will have a beautiful life and that if his autodidactive evasion of the law taught him anything, it's that absolutely anything is possible.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, we'll meet the ladies of Rose Bent, a local all-female hip-hop crew. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy with temperatures in the low 80s. And then rain and cooler temperatures starting Sunday.
It's 5:17 p.m., time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
The giant banks that wrecked our economy are thriving today, thanks to public funds that Washington continues to make available to them, even as the middle class continues to sink. Yet those same narcissistic bankers wonder why they are so despised by the public. But wait, some of the giants now have a plan to reach out to you common wretches and make you feel all warm and fuzzy about them. Get ready to welcome the new Neighborhood Bank, the return of convenient brick-and-mortar branches right where you live. For example, J.P. Morgan Chase, the nation's biggest banker, sees these facilities becoming community centers, like the old corner banks with countertops of cool marble and friendly tellers who knew you by name. Only, no tellers will actually be present. Rather, the, quote, branch of the future, as J.P. Morgan refers to its new edifices, are to be electronic centers with the hip feel of an Apple store. You'll do most transactions yourself on automated machinery that offers the same personal touch you get from, say, the ticket machine in a subway station. Oh, you can, of course, still chat with a teller, only he or she will be off-site, perhaps even offshore, coming to you through the warm glow of a video screen. In fact, that human disconnect is the whole idea behind these reinvented neighborhood branch banks. Why pay people to handle your withdrawals, sign you up for loans, or just generally relate to you? With computers, the banks can make you do their work and still sock you with transaction fees, meaning more money being siphoned out of your neighborhood and transferred to the bank's faraway executives and wealthy investors. This is Jim Hightower saying, J.P. Morgan's head of consumer banking, who's overseeing this project, confesses that, to be honest, we don't know if we have it right. Trust me, sir, you don't.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Late last night, the Texas House of Representatives passed legislation to regulate the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, otherwise known as drones. FSRN's Teddy Wilson reports.
Legislation that would make it illegal to use drones passed the Texas House Thursday night. House Bill 912 would make it a Class C misdemeanor if a person uses or authorizes the use of drones to, quote, capture an image without the express consent of the person who owns or lawfully occupies the real property captured in the video. The bill also lays out specific exemptions to the law, including firefighting and rescue operations. Law enforcement officials lobbied for a blanket exemption to use drones for police purposes, but the legislation requires they obtain a warrant. The law does include a blanket exemption for border security covering a 25-mile-wide swath along the length of the Texas-Mexico border. Yesterday, a bipartisan group of state lawmakers in Wisconsin announced a bill to prevent law enforcement from using drones without a warrant. This comes as the FFA is scheduled to begin testing the use of drones for commercial purposes in U.S. airspace. Teddy Wilson, FSRN, Texas.
Facebook is rumored to buy Waze, a social mapping app valued up to $1 billion. Waze currently hosts over 47 million users and records live data of traffic jams, police sightings, and car accidents. If Facebook adopted the Waze map, they could tie the location data to identities of their users. Location sharing would open up new avenues for advertising dollars. The data would provide advertisers with highly valuable demographic and social information and would also allow businesses to post coupons and special offers for nearby customers. This new feature would put Facebook in direct competition with another app, Foursquare, which is based solely on location check-ins. If Facebook users do not use their map in the same way, Facebook might have to consider offering incentives such as free Wi-Fi to prompt its users to check in.
An innocuous-sounding photo tool mandate hidden within the 800 pages of a new immigration reform bill will create a national photo database of nearly all adult Americans. The database will rely on biometric identification techniques that measure the contours of the face. It will allow employers to verify that a prospective hire is who they say they are. Privacy advocates have identified a creep effect that has marked federal identification systems in the past. Social Security cards, created to track retirement benefits, have now become a necessary document for a wide range of purposes, from purchasing insurance to borrowing money. The Competitive Enterprise Institute warns that the proposed photo tool could be the impetus for a national ID used to restrict activities far beyond employment. If the provision passes, it will provide the infrastructure for a new means of tracking access and behavior, where your face itself will take the place of a state-issued ID card. The Senate Judiciary Committee is set to resume debate on the immigration bill next Tuesday.
A global flash mob of hackers managed to steal $45 million from ATMs around the globe last night. Hackers got into bank databases and increased the limits on prepaid debit cards. They then created access codes, which people downloaded onto cards with a magnetic stripe that could hold the data. Old phone cards, hotel key cards, and other magnetic stripe cards are able to hold any data that is loaded onto them. And in this case, that vulnerability allowed a network of hackers to withdraw large amounts of money from ATMs. But no individuals actually lost money, since the hackers withdrew money from accounts used by banks to back up prepaid debit cards. Banks have decided to absorb the loss, since tracking the individuals involved is extremely difficult. Seven people have been arrested in New York in connection with the $45 million heist.
With this week's announcement of record profits for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a low-income housing coalition has called on the government to force the nation's biggest lending companies to make required contributions to the National Housing Trust Fund. The 2008 Housing and Economic Recovery Act, signed by then-President George W. Bush, required that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac pay a portion of their profits into a government trust fund. But that requirement was suspended the same year when the two companies failed and were taken over by the government. Now the government trusteeship has ended, the companies are again making profits, and housing rights associations are calling on the government to enforce the law. Dr. Sheila Crowley is the head of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition.
One of the provisions in that act was to establish the National Housing Trust Fund with the purpose of creating a new program to expand the supply of rental housing for the poorest people in the country. The initial source of funding for that program was to be contributions from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's what the statute requires. The statute also allows the regulator, in this case is now Mr. DeMarco, to suspend those payments under certain circumstances related to the financial health of Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie are making considerable profits at this point. Those profits are going to the federal treasury. They're not going to the stockholders anymore under the agreement between the Federal Housing Finance Agency and the Treasury. But the statute supersedes that, and so they really have the obligation to be making these contributions to the trust fund now. And we think that they should be making it retroactive to the first quarter of 2012. Our position is that they should begin making the contributions. The contributions are not, I mean, they're making, you know, $50 billion in profits this quarter or more. They're supposed to be making contributions that would be the equivalent of about $500 million a year, just not, they're not going to miss it. But it's just ridiculous that Mr. DeMarco is refusing to allow that to happen.
That was Dr. Sheila Crowley. Fannie Mae's announcement of $60 billion in profits this quarter should result in $500 million going to the housing trust. But Edward DeMarco, the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, has not yet required the company to obey the law.
The European Commission has imposed a 2-year precautionary ban on 3 pesticides linked to the decline of honeybees. The European Union reached an inconclusive vote on the ban last month, leaving the decision to the European Commission, the EU's legislative body. The decision is based on a study by the European Food Safety Authority, which found the neonicotinoid-based pesticides pose a risk to bees' health. The pesticides will be banned for seed treatment, soil application, and treatment on crops attractive to bees. The moratorium will be effective beginning December 1st and will restrict the use of the pesticides until more is known about how they may affect bees. In the United States, the EPA is reviewing the safety of the pesticide in question. This process will take several years. But U.S. beekeepers, who lost an average of 45% of their colonies last winter, warn that certain pesticides should be restricted immediately. If not, they say that bee colony collapse could result in the eradication of honeybees in the U.S.
Atmospheric carbon dioxide levels have passed 400 parts per million for the first time in human history, says climate researcher in Hawaii. The percentage of CO2 in the atmosphere has risen drastically since the advent of industrial society, when the concentration was just 200 parts per million. The British Energy Secretary says this milestone is another piece of clear scientific evidence of the effect human activity has on the planet. Levels of CO2 this high have not been present on Earth for somewhere between 3 and 5 million years. International agreements have mandated that the 1 degree Celsius rise in global temperature must be curbed before it passes the 2 degree mark. Past that point, an acceleration in climate change will reach a point of no return. The current rate of change in CO2 levels, 75 times that of pre-industrial times, shows little sign of abating under the current political situation. The International Energy Agency warned last year that based on current emission trends, the world's temperature will rise by 6 degrees Celsius, or 11 degrees Fahrenheit, by the end of the century. The agency says that to avoid that extinction-level crisis, human societies must reduce carbon emissions to below 350 parts per million.
This week, the government of the Marshall Islands declared a state of emergency, saying prolonged drought conditions have caused a shortage of fresh water in the northern Pacific Island group of atolls. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has sent a disaster team to the area. Spokesperson Jens Lerke says most of the domestic water tanks on the four atolls are completely empty.
Water in the wells is considered unsafe to drink due to bacterial contamination and high levels of salt. Most of the installations for water purification and desalination are also operating below capacity. The food crops there, mainly breadfruit and banana, are also reportedly devastated due to the drought. Obviously, especially the lack of drinking water is of high humanitarian concern, particularly for the children.
A judge today found former Guatemalan dictator Efrain Rios Montt guilty of genocide and sentenced him to 80 years in prison. Rios Montt was found responsible for the massacre of more than 1,700 indigenous Mayans during his rule in the early 1980s. During the trial, dozens of victims and family members gave testimony of murder, rape, and torture committed by government soldiers under Rios Montt's command. Yesterday, lawyers for the general gave their closing arguments, and Rios Montt addressed the court for the first time. He said, quote, "I never authorized, I never signed, I never proposed, I never ordered an attack on any race, ethnicity, or religion. I never did. And there's no evidence of my participation in anything they've said," unquote. Until recently, Rios Montt had escaped prosecution because he had immunity as an elected official. After reading the verdict, Judge Barrios instructed Guatemala's public ministry to continue investigating other individuals for similar prosecutions.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Meyer, Robin Ryan, Evan Owen Stively, Rachel Bennett, Kristen Yount, and Audrey Davis. The producer is Zeke Harrington. Special thanks to the reporters at Free Speech Radio News. You can hear more of their stories at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264 AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220 HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Young.
I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey interview Evgeny Morozov, author of To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism, and Net Delusion. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus, a weekly interview show about our place on the planet. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, Ralph Coulson interviews Michael Mead, renowned storyteller, author, and scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology. Mead has spent decades of work mentoring youth, visiting prisons, assisting war veterans, and fostering dialogues between genders and races. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses. Tonight we'll meet the ladies of Rose Bent, a local all-female hip-hop crew. The Buddha said, if we could see the miracle of a single flower clearly, our whole life would change. Good night, Emily.
Good night, Liam.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, when the White House announced in late April that it suspected the Syrian government of using sarin nerve gas, those suspicions quickly became facts in many corporate media. When on-the-ground reporting emerged, casting doubt that chemical weapons had been used in Syria at all, those stories were largely ignored. We'll discuss rumors of weapons of mass destruction and unlearned media lessons with Counterspin's own Peter Hart. Also on the show, U.S. media were outraged at the news that Afghan President Hamid Karzai receives cash payments from the CIA. Much of the outrage was directed at Karzai, strangely, though the CIA came in for some criticism, too. But our guest suggests that brouhaha serves mainly to divert the public from the far bigger and still untold story of the corrupting influence of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan. We'll talk about that with playwright, journalist, and author Dalep Hero. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
It's fun to think for a minute about what pundit debates might look like if pundits could be drafted. Would they perhaps not froth quite so much at the idea of going to war? Back in reality, though, the U.S. pundit class is engaged in out-frothing one another over the prospect of war with Syria. We've heard talk of red lines and fears of looking weak, and now we have the bemused confusion over the fact that regular people, it turns out, just aren't that keen to send more people off to kill and be killed. On ABC's This Week on May 5th, George Stephanopoulos remarked that the public is not rushing, and Cokie Roberts described that as a huge problem. Americans may be disillusioned with wars, she said, because they're costing families money, not to mention, of course, the lives, she added. But, well, here's Roberts.
It really takes a whole foreign policy option off the table when Americans say that they don't want to have our troops engaged in another war. And that's a problem because we need to have every single option available in a very dangerous world.
That U.S. military actions might themselves be making the world more dangerous is not up for discussion, much